So you ready to wrestle with God this morning? This is our passage, so I hope so. There was a great scene in the movie Forrest Gump in which Lieutenant Dan finally has it out with God. He's been bitter for many years because he feels he has been robbed not only of his legs by a war wound in Vietnam, but also of his destiny, which is to die a glorious death in battle. But now on the Gulf of Mexico, there is a fierce storm that is rising, and Lieutenant Dan senses that God is in the middle of the storm and that God has hostile intentions. Therefore, he relishes this opportunity, and he embraces it wholeheartedly. He straps himself to the mast of the shrimp boat that he is on, and he lets God have it. He yells out at God. He says, "You'll never sink this boat. Come on. You call this a storm? It's time for a showdown. You and me. I'm right here. Come on." Now, I would say that's a conflict with God. And his conflict with God reaches its climax on the Gulf of Mexico. Our man Jacob also has a conflict with God. He has mostly been unaware of it, but it finally comes out into the open and it reaches its climax on the bank of the River Jabbok. God meets Jacob in apparent hostility. I wonder if God also meets us also in apparent hostility, and that he wounds us like he's going to wound Jacob in this passage, and that he wounds us only to bless us in the end. Turn with me to our passage this morning in Genesis chapter 32. We're going to pick up the story in verse 24. A little context here. Jacob is on his way back to the promised land after 20 years of exile. And he has extricated himself from Haran. He has extricated himself from Laban. But now he has to face his brother. His brother who, by all appearances, is intent on killing him. He has received word that Esau is coming out to meet him with 400 men, apparently with hostile intentions. And now Jacob is afraid of his brother Esau. So we pick up the story, Genesis chapter 32, verse 24. "So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, 'Let me go, for it is daybreak.' But Jacob replied, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.' The man asked him, 'What is your name?' 'Jacob,' he answered. The man said, 'Your name will no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome.' Jacob said, 'Please tell me your name.' But he replied, 'Why do you ask my name?' Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, 'It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared.' The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, this day the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon." Now Jacob has managed to get himself alone. He has stripped himself of all his possessions, which are many, and he has separated himself from his family, and he is all alone, with nothing to protect himself with. And then this stranger leaps out of the dark and attacks him. And this is a titanic struggle. And Jacob is worried about his confrontation with Esau, but he has more than he can handle with this particular character. This contest is a long one, for it goes until daybreak. However, the match is even. You might call it a tie. And near the end, this strange visitor wrenches Jacob's hip with a mere flick of the wrist, which would probably leave Jacob to ask, and us readers to ask as well at this point in the narrative, who is this man with these strange powers? And what could he possibly be up to? And why didn't he use these strange powers until now? And why is he wrestling Jacob to a draw when quite clearly he could defeat him with his overwhelming powers? We're given a tantalizing hint by a wordplay that takes place in the passage. The word wrestled in Hebrew is Yabbok, which sounds very much like Jacob's name, Jacob. And the name of the river, the scene of this particular encounter is the Jabbok or Yabbok, which also sounds very much like Jacob's name. So we get the idea that this encounter has something to do with Jacob's name, which is to say it has something to do with his character, his identity, and his destiny. And in this encounter with this visitor, this strange visitor, he is injured in a critical area. The significant thing about this is that now he will be vulnerable in his encounter with Esau. Jacob, the man of strength, is injured in an absolutely crucial area. Perhaps he expects to have some kind of wrestling match with Esau, and now he is incapacitated. And now this strange visitor with these strange powers asks Jacob to release him. Now, what's that about? If he has all this power, certainly he could release himself, but he humbles himself and he asks Jacob to release him. Jacob knows quite clearly at this point that he has met his match. He is hobbled, he is deeply wounded, he is in pain, and yet at this point he holds on. He must believe that the intentions of this strange visitor are benevolent. At first they appeared hostile, but since this man did not destroy him, did not use all of his powers, somehow Jacob concludes that this man must have good intentions. Therefore, he holds on, and he wants a blessing. Now, remember, Jacob already has a blessing. He has the patriarchal blessing. How did he get that blessing? He got it from his father. Doing what? Posing as Esau. Posing as his brother Esau. He was able to trick his father into giving him a blessing. But to receive a blessing, because you convince somebody else that you actually are somebody else, in the end, doesn't feel like much of a blessing. Now Jacob recognizes that he is in the presence of somebody who is superior, and he wants a real blessing, a face-to-face blessing from somebody he recognizes as superior. The visitor asks Jacob a question. What is your name? On the face of it, a very simple question, but with this particular question, in this man's life, what this visitor is doing is giving Jacob a tour of his entire life. Jacob, what does that name mean? Or what at least did it come to mean? Heel grabber, supplanter, deceiver. And Jacob has done his best to live up to that name in his encounters with Isaac and Esau and Laban. He has been the deceiver, the supplanter, the heel grabber. And when Jacob was asked a very similar question by his father 20 years ago, here's how it went. Isaac said to him, as Jacob approached him, seeking the blessing, "Who are you, my son?" Jacob answers, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Get up, please, sit and eat of my game, that you may bless me." Same question, 20 years later, seeking a blessing. How does he answer the question? One word. Jacob, who has used a multitude of words in his life in order to manipulate his world, in order to spin it according to the way he wanted to receive it, now uses simply one word, and he uses his name, Jacob. He confesses. For the first time in this man's life, he confesses. He says, "I am Jacob. I am the heel grabber. I am the supplanter. I am the deceiver. And yes, I want a blessing. Me, even me, as myself, confessing that I am this man." The stranger gives him a new name, the name Israel. This name is related to the verb struggle, which appears in our text, and it connects with Jacob's contentious nature, for the explanation is given that Jacob has struggled with God and with men. And yet the visitor proclaims a very strange victor in these encounters. He says, "The victor is Jacob. You have overcome. You have prevailed." Now we ask the question, how can it be said that Jacob has overcome in his conflicts in life, and even his latest conflict here with this stranger. The match is even. The stranger obviously could have won if he wanted to. How can it be said that Jacob has been victorious? What is the victory? The victory is in his wound. Jacob has fought so long and so hard with God and with people that in the end, finally, he snapped. Quite literally. He pushed so hard against life, and life pushed back. He is wounded so that he can fight no longer. For Jacob, his injury is the final step on the road to self-discovery. He has learned now through this wound the limitations of his strength. And remember, he was an incredibly strong man, able to move that stone that covered the well with just a push. He has learned the weakness of his heel-grabbing ways. He has struggled with men and with God and been wounded. In other words, he has been wounded and he has won. His victory is in his wound. And his wound has taught him to answer simply, Jacob. And then to hold on and ask for a blessing. This new name embraces a new destiny. The name Israel. He's going to be the father of a nation. He's going to be the father of the most important nation. And this name is also going to evoke his injury. It would be a reminder to Jacob for the rest of his life that his strength would be in his weakness. And now Jacob asks a question of the visitor. He says, "What's your name?" And we have to compare a little bit some other passages to kind of get the impression of what's going on here. Particularly if you look at Judges 13, you don't have to turn there, but there's an encounter there that Manoah has with an angel of the Lord, Manoah being Samson's father. This encounter with the angel of the Lord, it turns out to be God himself. And so we take it from that passage and a few others that essentially what this visitor seems to be saying to Jacob is, don't you know the answer? Don't you know who I am? And at this point, the visitor grants Jacob the blessing that he sought. But we're never told the content of the blessing. Perhaps Jacob is never even told the content of the blessing either. The blessing comes as something of an anticlimax in this story. The important thing is not the content of the blessing, but the place of the blessing, at least in this case. The narrator tells us that the visitor blessed Jacob there. In this particular place, in the place where he wounded him, that's the place of blessing. So the place of wounding for Jacob then becomes the place of blessing. He names this place Peniel, which means face of God. And he explains, I saw God face to face and my life was spared. And Jacob finally figures it out. At some point, perhaps he figured it out. And now he comes out into the open with it. He identifies this visitor as God himself. Apparently God himself appeared as a man briefly on the scene. And of course this would be a precursor to thousands of years later when God himself would take the form of a man, become Jesus Christ permanently as a man. Now one of the amazing things in this is that Jacob survives this encounter with the holy God. Jacob, of all people, the deceiver, the conniver, the manipulator, would not expect to survive such an encounter with the holy God. And yet Jacob survives. Note here the humility of God. The match is even. God asks Jacob to release him, and Jacob's life is spared. However, his hip is not spared. Jacob also is not spared, at least not the old Jacob. Today, a new Jacob is born. Now the narrator reports a sunrise. This is very poetic in the narrative. We last heard about the sun 20 years ago in the narrative. Jacob was leaving the promised land on his way to Haran, And the sun set at that particular point. The narrator lets us know that. And so he's telling us essentially that it's been 20 years of darkness for Jacob. And now finally he reports a sunrise. And he reports a sunrise in connection with Jacob himself. The sun is spoken of in terms of its orientation toward Jacob. The sun rose on Jacob. And so as Jacob emerges from the darkness, as he emerges from this amazing encounter with God, he feels the warmth of a new day. This is a new Jacob. This is a new day. This is a new era. However, he is limping into his new life. And very significantly, he is limping into his encounter with Esau, who he is terrified of. Now, the Israelites then commemorated this particular encounter, Jacob's encounter with God. And not only did they commemorate it, but they also identified with Jacob through it. And they would come to believe and come to understand that they were supposed to identify with Jacob and his wound as well. This encounter and the fact that they commemorated in this way is supposed to be a signal to Israel that she is going to be a wounded nation and that she is going to achieve victory. She is going to prevail. She is going to overcome through her wounds. Is it any wonder then that the Messiah of Israel, at the most crucial juncture in his life, separated himself from his disciples, as Jacob separated himself from his family? Jacob, who encountered God on the bank of the river Jabbok, the Messiah, who encountered God in the Garden of Gethsemane, each of them all alone. Jacob, wounded by God, the Messiah, wounded for the transgressions of the world. But that is the victory, right? That is the Messiah's victory. That is the victory of the people of God. That is the victory for the world. The wounded Messiah, the wounded nation, the wounded church. And now we, as the church of Jesus Christ, as his followers, we are commanded to take up our crosses and to bear the pain of the world. And to feel something of the world's pain in order that we can bring the healing of Jesus Christ to the world in part through our own wounds. By sharing maybe even our wounds with our friends. Well, I have four basic reflections on how we might consider this, how we might incorporate this into our own lives. Number one, wrestling with God. Well, we don't expect to encounter God this way, do we? We don't expect him to leap out of the darkness. We don't expect to come to church on a Sunday morning and worship God, and all of a sudden he attacks us. Right? But sometimes he does just that, right? You get hot under the collar as you're singing, as you hear the word preached, and you feel like there, you just got to get out of here. There's, you know, you don't want to be here, and it's not completely because the sermon is boring. God is speaking to you and you're not sure you like it. But I wonder what it would be like if this actually happened. If we all came to church here one Sunday morning and God attacked. And it's a wrestling match. And I'd really like to referee that one. You know, 2 points, takedown, a reversal or something like that. The only problem is I'm sure he'd be coming to wrestle with me as well. The truth is that most of us are more concerned about our encounters with the Esaus of this world than we are with our encounters with God, at least until God approaches us in apparent hostility. And our conflicts with God usually have something to do with our identity, something to do with our character, something to do with our destiny. We want to know, who are we? How should we live our lives? Or perhaps we don't want to know. Because we're afraid of what the answers are. We're afraid of what God might demand of us. The answers emerge, whether we like it or not, often in the middle of our conflict with God. Many of us wrestle with God into the night and into the years. Some of us wrestle with God for many, many years before finally yielding to him. Some of us wrestle with God our entire lives and never yield. But note this. God does not destroy us. He only wounds us. But He wounds us so that we will feel vulnerable in our world without what we think is essential for life. I think in talking to people, I've kind of gathered that most of us think that we are lacking something essential in life. We're lacking a certain intellect, appearance, skills, resources, money, friends, relationships. We feel like we are lacking something. And we think if we just had that one particular thing or this one particular area of wounding would be healed, then we could make our way through life. We are vulnerable in this world. Well, do you resonate with this? Do you resonate with the idea that maybe you might be wrestling with God? I don't know whether you are or not, but here's our text this morning. Perhaps God is speaking to us. Number two, seeking God's blessing. Here we have the humility of God. Our matches with God are even. He does not overpower us. He actually asks us to release Him, to let Him be who He is and do what He wants to do in our lives. And we have to realize we can't win. The best we can achieve is a tie. God's not going to overpower us, but we are not going to defeat God. And when you realize this, then it's time to give up. But when you give up, don't let go. Hold on. Hold on. Perhaps like Jacob, you have grasped for things your entire life, but you have never held on to God, at least not like this before. And you haven't done so because you've doubted His intentions. You haven't been convinced of His goodness. You're worried about what He's going to ask you to do. Therefore, you have stiff-armed God, and you've been kind of in a silent conflict with God, perhaps your whole life. But now, as this conflict with God comes out in the open, and you realize that He has not destroyed you, somehow you are convinced, like Jacob, that His intentions for you are good. And so now you cling to God for all you're worth, even if you're hobbled, even if you're in pain, especially if you're in pain. Perhaps like Jacob, you have tried to be someone else in order to get the blessing from your world. You have tried to be essentially Esau. And maybe you've been able to pull it off. Maybe your world has in some sense blessed you or blessed who you tried to be. But in the end, it feels no better to you than it did to Jacob to receive a blessing because you've been able to convince your world that you are somebody else. It's a false blessing, and you know it deep in your bones, and you want something else. You want something real. You want something better. You want something face to face, and you want it from God. And He asks you a question. What's your name? And He gives you a tour of your life. You know what the answer to that question is? For you and for me? Jacob. There is a Jacob in each one of us. A deceiver, a manipulator, a conniver, a heel grabber. He's there. He's there in all of us. But perhaps we have not been willing to admit it. You see, because we don't think that person is going to get a blessing. We think we have to transform ourselves into some good, perfect person, and then maybe our world, maybe God, will bless us. Perhaps maybe it's time to confess ourselves. Yes, I am Jacob. And so we answer. I am Jacob. I am the heel grabber. I am the supplanter. And I want a blessing. Me. I want a blessing. And we see in this that maybe our whole life has been like this, in conflict with God. And we've tried to be somebody else to get blessed, and God will have none of it. So He meets us sometimes in apparent hostility. Brennan Manning wrote a very interesting letter. He wrote it to himself. Actually, he wrote it to the Jacob within himself, who he calls the imposter, the false self, and even you little jerk. Here's what he wrote to himself. When I was a little shaver and first knew that no one was there for me, you intervened and showed me where to hide. At that moment in time, you were invaluable. Without your intervention, I would have been overwhelmed by dread and paralyzed by fear. You were there for me and played a crucial protective role in my development. Thank you. But then, your malevolent side appeared and you started lying to me. Brennan, you whispered, if you persist in this folly of being yourself, your fellow long-suffering friends will hit the bricks, leaving you all alone. Stuff your feelings, shut down your memories, withhold your opinions, and develop social graces so that you'll fit in wherever you are. And so the elaborate game of pretense and deception began. Sounds like Jacob, doesn't it? Because it worked, I raised no objection. As the years rolled by, you/I got strokes from a variety of sources. We were elated and concluded that the game must go on. But you needed someone to bridle you and rein you in. I had neither the perception nor the courage to tame you. So you continued to rumble like Sherman through Atlanta, gathering momentum along the way. Your appetite for attention and affirmation became insatiable. I never confronted you with the lie because I was deceived myself. The bottom line, my pampered playmate, is that you are both needy and selfish. You need care, love, and a safe dwelling place. On this last day in the Rockies, my gift is to take you where unknowingly you have longed to be, into the presence of Jesus. Your days of running riot are history. From now on, you slow down, slow very down. And in his presence, you will delight in the discovery of what it means to live by grace and not performance. Perhaps we might write such a letter ourselves, to ourselves, or at least resonate with the spirit of Manning's letter. Number three, the strange victory. There is a way to prevail in our amazing conflicts in life and our amazing conflicts even with God. We fight so long and so hard against people and against God that finally maybe one day we snap. Perhaps not physically, perhaps emotionally. We push so long and so hard, we push against life, finally life pushes back. Life, and even God himself sometimes, wounds us. And we are in pain. But the amazing thing is, that's how we win. That's how you triumph. If you accept the wound, if you embrace the wound, you become the victor. You triumph. The wound teaches us finally to answer Jacob, not Esau. The wound teaches us extraordinary trust. Think about Jacob holding on to this strange visitor who he knows can kill him because he wants a blessing, because he is ultimately convinced that his intentions are good. That's extraordinary trust. Now come into the presence of God, holding on to him, clinging to him, hoping, praying for a blessing when you know he can destroy you. You want to get that close to him? He can kill you, you know, but he won't because his intentions are good. The wound teaches us that our strength is to be found in our weakness. And the wound gives us a new destiny. And it enables us to enter our world as ourselves. What many people find is that their destiny is wrapped around their wound. The place where you hurt the most is often the place where you have the most to offer. Let me say that again. The place where you hurt the most is often the place where you have the most to offer. Larry Crabb writes about his grandmother, who later in life went blind. And as a teenager, he asked his grandmother, "What's it like to be blind?" Here was her answer. "Oh, Larry, I can pray so much better for you now than when I could see. Blindness cuts down on the distractions." Can you imagine what that would be like as a teenager
to ask your grandmother that kind of question and get that kind of response, knowing that she is thankful for her blindness because it makes it better for her to pray for you? Here is a woman who embraced her wound and found a new destiny that was centered on prayer. Number four, and finally, the new you. Perhaps in our conflicts with people and our conflicts with God, God has been whispering all along to us, "Don't you know who I am? Don't you know this is me here with you? Don't you know that you are in conflict with me?" Well, God fights against us. He actually helps us give up in order to bless us and fight for us. He blesses all us deceivers who are willing and courageous enough to come out of hiding. And just as he blessed Jacob there in the place where he wounded him, he blesses us there in the place where he wounds us. The place of wounding then for us becomes the place of blessing. Jacob the deceiver is not destroyed. Neither are we destroyed. And we can be assured of this because of the coming of Jesus Christ. And Paul tells us that we can actually look into the face of Christ. And he tells us that when we look into the face of Christ, we are actually looking into the face of God. And when we do so, not only are we spared, but we are saved and transformed. Astounding. But in your encounter with God, what you consider your strength may not survive. You won't survive either, at least not the old you. A new person is born. But as you emerge from the darkness, and as you emerge from this conflict with God, like Jacob, you feel the warmth of a new day. But God has left his mark on you, and you limp into the future and into your meetings with the Esaus of your world, vulnerable, but dependent upon the strength of your God. It's a new way of walking. Brendan Manning memorably calls this the victorious limp. And now you see yourself as being part of the wounded nation, the church of Jesus Christ. The church of Jesus Christ who are wounded just like he is in some way, in order to bring his healing to the world. So God wounds us in our conflicts with him only to bless us in the end. His intentions are only apparently hostile. And when we stop wrestling with God and start clinging to him, we find that his intentions for us are good and that they have been good all along. So I wonder, is this true? Maybe we have been wrestling with God all along, but he hasn't been wrestling with us. What he's really been doing is embracing us with his love. Cliff and the band, would you come forward? We're going to do one more hymn. And this is one of the great hymns, Amazing Grace. And is God's grace that amazing that he would wound us and it would be a blessing and that we would be blessed far beyond anything that we could imagine?